Welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 21st of June 2021 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. And just before we get into the podcast, I just wish to remind listeners that we do require donations at Radio Albion to keep the website going. We do have a selection of cryptocurrency addresses that you can donate to. I've just had to purchase a new computer. So if anybody can afford to, and they can afford to send some donations our way, they would be gratefully received. Well, it's Monday again. It's the beginning of the week. And that means that I have here with me today my co-host Max Musson from Western Spring to discuss the week's news and also to get into our Greatest Britain segment later on in the podcast. Max, good day, sir. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you very much. I think we've got we've had a week behind us now that has had a number of interesting stories that we can talk about, and I'm looking forward to further developing our discussion with regard to Robert Blatchford, who is somebody who is who has hitherto been underappreciated by the by nationalist movements and by the British public at large, I would say.
Well, he was certainly setting the standards with his moustache, I have to say. We should have mentioned that earlier on in the series. What an absolutely fantastic moustache the man actually has. I do recommend people check out the picture of him, but we'll be getting into that later on. First off, I think we're going to be talking about the Amersham and Chesham by-election, where the Tories were beaten, and also Labour. And I believe it was the worst Labour defeat for decades, absolutely decades. They didn't even manage to get their deposit back. I mean, they were absolutely trounced. And the Tories didn't do well either. It was actually the Liberal Democrats that won. But Max, I believe you've been looking into this. You're the man for the elections. What are your thoughts on it?
Right, well, look, it is rather surprising because if anybody's visited Amersham and Chesham, then they will know that that particular area of England is a traditional Tory heartland, and as we've said, the Amersham and Chesham constituency has been held by the Conservatives. In fact, it's been held by the Conservatives for 47 years since the constituency was first created, and during the last election there, the Conservatives polled something like about 55% of the vote. I think the Lib Dems only polled something like about 25% of the vote. But that situation's been completely turned on its head with the recent by-election that's been held there, where the Sarah Green, who is the Liberal Democrat candidate, scored 56% of the vote with a majority of 8,000. And the Conservatives were left with only around about 35% of the vote. And so it was a very remarkable defeat of the government, and I mean, all governments expect to not do quite as well midterm as they do at actual general elections, but I think that this sort of a turnaround at such a safe Conservative seat must be something which is very worrying for the Conservatives. In looking at the things that were the main issue during the course of the election, HS2, which is the high-speed railway linking the south of England with the north, was one of the big issues that came up. But also the placing of authority for planning decisions in the hands of quengos was another very powerful issue. And this is an issue which is being hotly debated and has been for some time all over the south of England, certainly, and possibly further afield, because what's happened is that the governments, or recent Conservative governments particularly, have taken to the habit of usurping the power that local authorities would normally have over making planning decisions and placing the power to decide those sort of planning decisions in the hands of quengos and the HS2. Planning decisions were taken by central government, but the decisions over housing and new housing have been placed in the hands of quengos, and the government have published in the past their plans for there to be 300,000 new homes built in England or Britain every year. And these quangos are deciding where these new housing developments should go. And they're causing quite a lot of anger amongst traditional conservative voters and voters generally, because what's happening is that villages are suddenly being made much larger than they've been in the past. Lots of greenbelt area is being consumed with these new housing developments. And of course, you have to ask yourself, you know, why do we need 300,000 new houses each year? Because the population growth in this country amongst the indigenous people of Britain is in negative figures. You know, we're not producing as a nation enough children to replace our numbers, and so whereas Britain in the past has become a crowded island, you know, we are in the situation where if population increase was solely down to fertility, the overcrowding situation in the British Isles would be rectified fairly quickly over perhaps a couple of decades with the low birth rate that we've got, requiring fewer houses and requiring less infrastructure. But in fact, the reverse is happening. What's happening is there is this demand, and the successive governments have been building. I've had these very ambitious house building projects, and we have to ask ourselves why that is. And the obvious reason is that the demand for all these new houses is coming from indigenous British people who are being displaced through white flight, and they're fleeing the large city centres and large town centres, and moving out to the country. But in reality, what's happening is that these additional houses are being built in order to accommodate mass uncontrolled immigration, because that's where the population growth is coming from. If there wasn't the mass uncontrolled immigration, then the white flight would end and there would be no need for all these houses. And so when people complain about house prices constantly going up, when you talk to younger friends who are just setting out in life and who are struggling to save enough money for a deposit so they can buy a house of their own, and they're complaining about the fact that house prices are so high, you need to point out to them every step and turn along the way that all these problems are being caused by mass immigration. Mass immigration and opposition to mass immigration isn't just about issues of race. Opposition to mass immigration is all to do with the quality of life that we have in this country. It pushes up house prices, it makes rental properties less available than they otherwise would be, and it places pressure on the infrastructure, on schools and hospitals and shops, and in terms of sewage disposal and things of that sort. And so even as far as the environment is concerned, you know, with the sewage disposal, with all these fatbergs, because, you know, we never used to get these fatbergs in the sewage systems in years gone by, but suddenly now we're getting all these fatbergs, and all these things are a problem, all our problems that are caused by an ever increasing population into a country where there are finite resources, because our country is not getting any bigger and the resources that we have available are slowly dwindling. And we can't afford to have this open door immigration policy any longer. Something needs to be done about it. And what needs to be done is that we need to start to elect nationalist candidates. So when nationalist candidates campaign against mass immigration, there should be nobody amongst the indigenous population complaining about them and accusing them of being racist. What people from the indigenous population should be doing is welcoming political parties that are fighting to stabilize the house pricing market, to stabilize the house rental market, to protect the infrastructure, to make sure that there are always enough schools to take care of the children that we have, to make sure that there are always enough hospitals to care for our sick, and to make sure that there always are enough shops and amenities and water and sewage systems to cope with the population that we've got. And that's really what is fundamental here, and people need to recognise that whenever there is talk about planning authority being taken out of the hands of local people, that's only being done so that the people making the planning decisions don't actually care. The authority can be placed in the hands of people who don't actually care about the local amenities because they don't live locally. They're people who are members of quangos who are making decisions that only affect the lives of people that live miles away from where they do.
It's all about care for the environment. I mean, this is a point that Patriotic Alternative have recently been making, that when they build these new houses, they're inevitably going to be on greenbelt land, and it destroys the natural habitat for the water voles, the red squirrels, the barn owls. All these traditional creatures that we have in Britain are now endangered. And you mentioned the fatbergs there, and that's a symptom of the people that are coming over here not caring about the country that they're living in. Why should they care about it? They've just come here to take whatever they can take from us. They care about their people, and their people come from other countries in the world. So they're not going to be concerned about the surroundings. They're not going to be concerned about the finite resources, because they can always go back to somewhere else. It's essentially somebody else's resources that they're using. It's the resources that our ancestors created that they're taking up. And the actual number of people that we produce, it's not even enough to fill the houses that are already here. We don't need to build new houses. All those new houses are being built for newcomers. None of them are being built for the people that are here, because we're not actually reproducing enough to replace the people that we already have here. So it's none of it is of benefit to the indigenous people. And I just got some details on the election. Labour picked up just 622 votes from the 37,954 people who cast their ballot. The party finished fourth in the heavily Remain backing area, behind the Green Party, who won 1,480 votes. So low was their share of the vote that Labour even lost its £500 deposit, which is usually returned if a candidate gets at least 5% of ballots cast. The 1.6% share of the vote is the worst Labour has ever done in a by-election since the party was formed by Keir Hardie in 1900. And that's incredible, because, you know, this is a Remain backing area. They wanted to remain in the EU. They were supportive of Labour's politics, and yet they have massively voted against them. They don't want to anything to do with them. I find that that's very interesting. It's not just that the Conservatives have lost out here, it's also the Labour Party. And I was thinking maybe it was to do with the coronavirus and the shutdown, and the fact that we weren't able to open up today as we were supposed to. And yet it seems that it's not even that. It's more to do with local issues and this HS2 thing. So Labour have really lost out there, but they have they and Conservative parties have also lost out. Apparently they've lost the wonderful ex-Speaker of the House, John Bercow, has resigned from the Conservative Party and has transferred over to Labour. And of course we've always said that he was a Labour stooge, really, that was pretending to be Conservative, and he lost his knighthood. I believe that the Speaker of the House is automatically given a knighthood normally, but because of his bending of the law and his overturning of all the traditions of the Speaker of the House in order to try and go against the democratic will of the British people and trying to overturn Brexit, he lost his knighthood. He stepped down in absolute disgrace, and now he's shown his true colours, and he's moved to Labour, which I think is going to harm Labour even more. I mean, they really are a busted flush. Keir Starmer really doesn't seem to be able to do anything to pick up Labour's lost votes. They lost in North Wales in traditional Labour seats when the Tories took over, and now they're losing out here. Perhaps the British public weren't so concerned about Jeremy Corbyn's criticism of the Jews, because of course when Keir Starmer actually took the role of leader, the first thing he said was, is Labour is going to do all we can to get the Jews back on board. We're going to do everything we can to help the Jews. I'm paraphrasing there, basically. He said nothing about helping the indigenous British people, nothing about helping the British working class. It was all about helping this small minority. And perhaps that has backfired on him. I mean, I don't know if there's calls for him to resign yet or not. What do you make of this, Max?
I think there are calls for him to resign, and I think that it would probably be quite a sort of a humorous move. It would be something that would actually probably elevate the Liberal Democrats in the estimation of the population of Britain if in future by-elections of this sort, if they, alongside their serious candidate, they got some of their students to arrange to stand a monster raving loony party candidate to humiliate the Labour Party in the way that they have traditionally tended to do in order to try and humiliate nationalist candidates when we stood in elections where we haven't expected to get a large percentage of the vote. But it would be really, really funny if one of the other political parties, or if some students that have got a good sense of humour in places where Labour Stand Again organised a monster raving loony party candidate to stand against the Labour candidate just in order to humiliate the Labour Party hubris in expecting that they're always going to get a large proportion of the votes, and to perhaps even humiliate the Conservative Party as well for their hubris in believing that they can ignore the wishes of local people.
Talking of students there, I think there was a very young Labour MP, a female MP, and she was on a shortlist of MPs because Labour wanted to get more women into Parliament, and she was also a person of colour, so she ticked two diversity boxes there, and she got voted in, and she was the youngest Labour MP, or the youngest female Labour MP. And she said she was only going to take half her wages and the other half were going to be donated to charity. And I think after, 6 months or a year, and she's now had to step down because she says it's too traumatic for her. And she's got post-traumatic stress syndrome. And so she's actually had to step down. It's too difficult for her in politics. And you just have to feel sorry for the people that were presented with her as their only choice, because she was just put in there because of a diversity quota. She wasn't, Labour didn't put her forward because she was the best person for the job. They just put her forward because she was a female and she was non-white. And the silly fools in that area ended up voting for her, I guess, because they're just so used to voting Labour all the time that they just do it automatically. And now she says she's got post-traumatic stress. It's all just too much for her, being a politician. I don't know if you want to add anything else to the political news, Max, before we move on to something else.
I don't really want to add anything more to that particular subject, I don't think, although there is the story that is in the news today of the BBC continuing their policy of advertising vacancies for non-white applicants only, and it appears that a company that works in partnership with the BBC has been advertising. The BBC presumably have been supporting this advertising for an £18,000 a year trainee production management assistant, where they have specified that the person that white people will not be considered for the role, and this is as a production management assistant for such programs as The One Show, Spring Watch, and the Truth About series. And so this is a really deplorable trend that we've seen in recent times, where the BBC have, in order to further their diversity and inclusion policy, have been advertising positions for non-white applicants only. And this is apparently allowed due to a concession that is within the Equality Act, but it is a concession that is allowed in such a way as to enable organisations to unfairly discriminate against white people, in my view. It's interesting that when you look at the BBC's diversity inclusion plan, what they say there is that they want to have their target is to have 50% of their staff as women, which is fair enough. I can't really see that there's any great issue with that. But they want to have 20% of the of their staff from black and minority ethnic communities, when in reality the black and minority ethnic community in this country isn't at 20%. And they say that what they want to do is they want the BBC to better reflect UK society. Well, UK society isn't 20% non-white. And so, you know, why are they pushing to have 20%? And in fact, from the appearances of people who appear on the BBC, certainly in recent years, I would think that that 20% quota has been filled already, unless there are lots of white people that are kind of hiding behind the camera and don't actually appear in front of the cameras. If anybody was just to make an assessment based upon the people who appear in front of the camera, they would think that the BBC was already at least 50% non-white in terms of its employees, and so that there wouldn't appear to be any work that needs to be done. But I've not seen 100% of the BBC's figures on the ethnic origins and the racial origins of the people that work for the BBC, so I couldn't really say for certain. But it's interesting that the BBC wants to better reflect UK society, but what they don't appreciate is that 16.4% of the population of the UK is over the age of 65. There's very, very little representation of people over the age of 65 on television. You get the occasional person who's worked on into their 60s, and occasionally you get the occasional person that's worked on into their 70s, but they're certainly not 16%, because 16 is one in six. And that would mean, you know, there certainly isn't one in six of the people working for the BBC who are over the age of 65. And so this is a massive demographic group that the BBC are just completely ignoring. And although, you know, the Equalities Act apparently states that it's illegal to discriminate against people on the basis of their age, it appears that nobody's actually enforcing that aspect of the Equalities Act. Because people over the age of 65 are discriminated against all the time, and certainly in terms of employment, and it would appear that organisations like the BBC, in terms of their diversity and inclusion quotas, have totally overlooked people over the age of 65, and so this is one basis for discrimination that the BBC doesn't feel is valid, apparently, and we ought to ask why.
Well, they do have Rip Off Britain with Angela Rippon. I mean, it's quite scary actually looking at that. Well, I mean, she isn't too bad, but her other two co-hosts, I mean, do you really want to see like really old, decrepit women on the television? I mean, there was a time when television used to just have the most beautiful people on there because you wanted something nice to look at. And this idea that you want to have old people on there, you want to have disabled people on there, you want to have black people on there. No, you want to look at beautiful things, perfect things. You know, you want to see things that people aspire to, just to know that there is some beauty out there. There are some people that are better off than you. You know, it used to be that people would be pleased to see that sort of thing and glad to know that there were some people out there that were like that. But no, they just want to put across this, I don't know, there's just this mediocrity all the time, and also making everything against whites. I mean, I don't understand how they can do it. I mean, positive discrimination is unlawful under the Equality Act 2010, but positive action is allowed for trainee and internship roles in areas where there is underrepresentation. Why is it always that it's us that have to change things? Why don't they say, well, we need more trainees and internships for non-whites, so they have to work a little bit harder. They need to get more non-whites involved in that sort of thing, if that's what they want. Obviously, they need to work harder at their media studies, or they need to get better at doing whatever it is that they're doing. It's not that the BBC are deliberately not employing people because they're black. I mean, as you pointed out there, Max, there's always already more representation of blacks and non-whites on the television than their percentage of the population. And there was a study done last year that looked at that, and that showed that there was more than their percentage, particularly with homosexuals. I mean, they've just got masses of homosexuals and transgenders. There's more transgenders at the BBC than in any other profession, I think, looking at the figures. It's just incredible. I think it was over 500 out of the few thousand people that were actually there. And I think it was about 10% were homosexual or lesbian, even though they only make up about 2% of the population. And the BBC were saying, oh, and we've still got more to do. We've still got more to do. And I guess what they mean by that is there are still some white people left there that we need to get rid of. And that's what this is. It's just an anti-white policy. Instead of saying, well, we want the best person for the job, they're saying, well, we just want somebody black or non-white for the job. And that means that you could get somebody there who doesn't have the qualifications, who's not interested in what they're doing. And this is why they end up with such a fast turnover of black and minority ethnics on the BBC and on the television. I don't know if you've noticed this, Max, but they'll put black people on there, and they'll only last for about 6 months because they turn out to not be any good at the job. You get the odd outliers that have a high IQ, and occasionally they will last. There's this guy that's doing the mastermind, Clive Myrie, and he's obviously in the top 1% of black people with his IQ, but even he isn't that bright, and he makes mistakes. I mean, he's good at reading, basically, which is, you know, quite a talent for some of these black and minority ethnics. I've seen some that actually play as actors, and then they'll go on a show where they discuss the newspapers, where they're expected to actually read from the newspaper. And it becomes quite clear that, you know, actually they're not really that bright, and it's embarrassing for them. I mean, if you're going to put people in a position like that and they're not actually very good at it, it's embarrassing for them. It's like Diane Abbott when she's put into the position of being the shadow Home Secretary. It's embarrassing because she's not very bright. Yes, she's in the top 10% of people of Caribbean heritage, but the top 10% of people of Caribbean heritage is just the average by the British standard of IQ. And of course, she makes all these mistakes. She can't add up. She can't count numbers. And people get accused of being racist for criticizing her, but they're basically just criticizing her because she's not up to doing the job. And you get the same thing with black actors, and you know, if they're having a problem getting them for trainee and internship roles, that means that they need to study more, or perhaps it's not really the position for them. I don't understand why we have to have black and minority ethnic people put everywhere. I mean, I don't see that they're putting white people everywhere in Africa. Quite the opposite, in actual fact. I mean, in South Africa, they still have all these diversity quotas in there, even though white people are now in the minority. It is just anti-white, but it does serve to wake people up to what is going on around them. I think more and more people are realizing that we have people in positions of power that do not have the indigenous people of Britain's best interests at heart. And that goes right the way through the media and through the government. I mean, thankfully we do now have an alternative news channel, GB News, and they actually got more viewing figures than Sky News and BBC News. But essentially what they're saying is, well, the leftists are the real racists. I mean, they have lots of black presenters, and I think the British people are getting sick of all this Black Lives Matter and seeing black people everywhere and seeing them promoted over whites, and just putting some black presenters in there that are conservative and talk about conservative views, that's just going to continue to wind people up. I mean, it's a bit of a limited hangout, this GB News, but they did have Priti Patel on there, and Priti Patel was supporting the right of football fans to boo the football team for taking the knee. They did come out as critical of the holding back of the Freedom Day on the 21st. They have had a discussion about vaccines on there, but at the same time, they've also had this Yasmin Alibi Brown on there, who is very, very hateful towards white people. I guess it's good that there is now another channel that people can watch, but it really sort of... It doesn't actually it's not ethno-nationalist. It's not really promoting the indigenous Britons. It's basically conservative. It's trying to portray the conservatives as actually conservative, whereas, of course, we know that they're not. And I guess really what it shows is that they're getting pretty desperate. They're getting pretty desperate. It may turn out to be better than Fox News. I don't know. It has had some basically people from the working class that are on there. They had an interesting guy the other day who had created a pop-out shelter for the homeless that a homeless guy could carry on a trolley behind him. But it probably cost about £500 each, so I could see that these trolleys would get stolen. But that shows that they are interviewing people from the street, and I do wonder if Laura Towler might actually be able to get on there with her startup for Grandma Towler's Tea, because that's the sort of thing that they're showing on there, and people that have been cancelled by the cancel culture. So if they really are open to interviewing everyone and open to seeing all sides of and hearing all from all sides, it would be good if we could see somebody from PA that are actually interviewed on there. Have you caught any of GB News, Andrew Neil's new adventure, Max, at all over the last week?
Am I right in my assumption that it is an internet-based news channel?
No, no. Channel, what is it? Channel 236 or 235, something like that, on Freeview.
I don't watch a tremendous amount of TV, but I couldn't seem to locate it when I was flicking through channels on my TV, and I only managed to find it on the internet. So I thought that perhaps it was just an internet-based news channel, but I shall have another look for it, I think. But I raised the issue of the BBC and our society in general not enforcing the anti-discrimination rules against older people, because the reason why they don't enforce anti-discrimination against older people is because the vast majority of older people, the overwhelming majority of people over the age of 65, are of course white people, and so the elderly are a demographic which is lumped in together with white people generally, and we've had the situation where despite the odd exceptions like Bruce Forsyth and the Angela Rippon that you've mentioned, generally speaking, white people aren't represented very much on, well, elderly white people aren't represented very much. In fact, elderly people generally aren't represented very much on television. And we've had instances like the announcement not so long back that a question of sport was going to be repopulated, and that Sue Barker and the two sports commentators, I can't think what their names are off the top of my head, are going to be replaced by new people, and this is going to be done in order to support the BBC's diversity and inclusion plans. And so obviously what we can expect is that the new people are going to come in to replace them are going to be diverse in some respect, and this goes against what very large sections, certainly I would say the majority of the indigenous British, actually want to see on television. And the whole thing really is deplorable. And we do need a new force like Patriotic Alternative to start to win the support of the public, so that these things can change, because they won't change unless the public change the way that they vote.
That's a good point about all the elderly being white, and that's why they don't want them on there. And also, they're more likely to have traditionalist conservative views as well, people that Absolutely. Are over 60. Well, shall we get into our Greatest Britons then?
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay, Greatest Britons for today, as we mentioned earlier, is Robert Peel Glanville Blatchford. And what we're going to do today is actually have a look through some of the quotes from his Merry England book. Now, I believe the book itself was a selection from his Clarion newspaper. Is that right, Max?
That I'm not absolutely sure of, but I would imagine that there probably would be a large area of overlap in any event, because the book was written at the same sort of time that the Clarion newspaper was being published. So I would think that there will be a great area of overlap. But Blatchford did very often refer in all of his writings to this this mythical Mr. Smith, who was the his equivalent of the man on the Clapham omnibus that he would address with the logic and the arguments he was putting forward in order to improve the governance of Britain.
So when he's when we're actually going through these quotes, he's basically, it's a hypothetical conversation between him and this Mr. John Smith. That's why he's mentioning the name Mr. Smith or John Smith as he goes through. Well, he starts off, he says, "To reject an idea because it is new is not a proof of shrewd sense. It is a proof of bigoted ignorance. To say that an idea is new is not to prove that it is untrue. The oldest idea was new once, and some of my ideas, as for instance the idea that justice and health are precious things, are considerably older than the House of Commons or Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations. If you wish for an instance of the value of new ideas, Mr. Smith, get a good life of Charles Darwin and another of George Stevenson and read them." And I'm obviously aware of Charles Darwin. Who's the George Stevenson that he's talking about here? Is that George Stevenson of the railways? Do you know?
I believe so, yes.
Wow. So again, so he's a fan of George Stevenson, one of our greatest Britons. He continues, "Now then, what is the problem? I call it the problem of life. We have here a country and a people. The problem is, given a country and a people, to find how the people may make the best of the country and of themselves. First then, as to the capacities of the country and the people. The country is fertile and fruitful and well stored with nearly all the things that the people need. The people are intelligent, industrious, strong, and famous for their perseverance, their inventiveness, and resource. It looks then as if such a people in such a country must certainly succeed in securing health and happiness and plenty for all. But we know very well that our people, or at least the bulk of them, have neither health nor pleasure nor plenty." Now, I think this is interesting because he's talking about the British people here, the British race. He says they're intelligent, industrious, strong, famous for their perseverance, their inventiveness and resource. And that's comparing the British people to the Italians, the Germans, the French. And this is at a time when we didn't just look at everybody as being the white race or as Europeans. We measured ourselves up against the other nations of Europe and the small differences that there are between them. I mean, I guess you could say that the Italians are very musical and they're very into their food. The Germans are very philosophical. And what he's saying here is that the British are industrious and very, very inventive and have perseverance. And this is what led to us getting the empire, basically. And that's really what stood out to me from that, is just this lovely description of the British people here. Max, what are your thoughts on this quote here?
Yeah, I would agree with that entirely. It's it is a statement of what would be regarded as the obvious if we were to go back 100 years, because it was evident that as far as the Industrial Revolution was concerned, that British inventors led the way as far as the Industrial Revolution was concerned. As far as the Agricultural Revolution is concerned, we led the way again with of agriculture. I think if you look at things that have been invented going back through history, then a very disproportionately large amount of the things that have been invented and a very disproportionately large number of the patents that exist on things that have been invented were things invented by British people. And certainly if you look at our literature, I think English literature is richer than the literature of virtually any other country, or at least stands comparable with the literature of any other highly literate nation. And so we have been a small island, but a small island that has, because of the stability created by the fact that we are an island, that we have had a society that has nurtured people who are inventive and self-reliant.
I think there, it's also descriptions of traits that are heritable as well: intelligent, industrious, strong, inventive, and resourceful. I mean, it's not like anybody can join that club. It's inheritable. It's talking about the ethnic nation. It's talking about things that the British people have inherited from their ancestors. I mean, to say that about that, you couldn't really say that about the country today. You couldn't say the British citizens are intelligent, industrious, strong, persevere in inventiveness and resource, because we're multicultural and they all have these different traits, rather than all working together and all knowing what their strengths are and what their weaknesses are. We don't have that anymore. We just have mediocrity. We don't have any great geniuses. Well, continuing. Now, I assert that if the labour of the British people were properly organised and wisely applied, this country would, in return for very little toil, yield abundance for all. I assert that the labour of the British people is not properly organised, nor wisely applied, and I undertake to show how it might and should be organised and applied, and what would be the results if it were organised and applied in accordance with my suggestions. The ideal of British society today is the ideal of individual effort or competition. That is to say, every man for himself. Each citizen is to try as hard as he can to get for himself as much money as he can, and to use it for his own pleasure and leave it for his own children. That is the present personal ideal. The present national ideal is to become the workshop of the world. That is to say, the British people are to manufacture goods for sale to foreign countries, and in return for those goods are to get more money than they could obtain by developing the resources of their own country for their own use. And I'll stop there. And it's got even worse now. We're not the workshop of the world. We're not manufacturing goods for sale to foreign countries. We just sell financial instruments, and it's all about the City of London. And what he's basically saying here is that everything is about individualism. This idea of it's the individual's right to make as much profit as he can from the people around him. And that's a multicultural way of looking at things, because you're not looking at everybody around you as a member of your family. You want the family to succeed. You're just looking, I want to succeed, and I'm going to take whatever I can from these people that are around me. And it goes all right against nature, because everything that we have comes from the people that came before us. No man is an island. The smallest unit of the nation is the family, not the individual. So what we can see here is that this was just really starting to take off, this idea of individualism, and he's looking at it and saying, well, no, this is wrong. We're going about this the wrong way. I do believe you do have to have a certain amount of competition, but we should be competing as a nation with other nations, rather than having this internationalism. And we should also be trying to raise up those among us who are the best at doing things, rather than taking from those that are the best at doing things and diverting all the attention on those that are the worst at doing things, that are never going to be able to be as good as the others. So we do have to have a certain amount of help for individuals and a certain amount of competition, but it needs to be done in such a way that it advances the cause of the nation rather than the cause of the individual, I feel. What are your thoughts on what he has to say here, Max?
Well, I agree with the last statement that you just made, that we do need to provide a means by which the individual can achieve their life's fulfillment and can achieve their potential in terms of developing themselves and developing and in terms of improving their life and the life of their family. But that should always be second to the efforts that groups of individuals make in advancing the nation and making the nation strong and providing for the welfare of the nation. The nation must always come first, but we must also respect the desire of individuals to achieve their full potential as well. But it's got to be that way round. If it's not that way round, then what you have is individuals competing against each other. And as you say, you have a situation where there are where the people around you are no longer regarded as members of your family, but are regarded as punters that are there for you to exploit, as a resource for you to exploit, rather than as a community for you to nurture and protect and to develop and to uplift. And that's really what we've got to what you've got to struggle to get over to the majority of people today, because you know the trends that Robert Blatchford argued against in the early 1900s are the same trends that still exist in Britain today, and it is the weakness of our country. You know, the desire to become the workshop of the world has meant that we have thrown over our economy to the mass production of finished goods and machinery and machine tools, etc., that in far greater quantities than we actually need, which has then meant that large areas of green land have been built over and concreted over in order to create these workshops. And of course, when you have an international economy where you're trying to be the workshop of the world, what happens is that there is a race to the bottom in terms of wages, where the country that has got the lowest wages is the country that's got the lowest production costs, and the country that is able to steal the technology of more inventive peoples is the country that has the lowest production costs, whereas the country that wants to look after the welfare of its people will have higher production costs. And the country where the people are devote a lot of their energy to invention also will have the highest production costs. And so therefore, in a world economy where we try to be the workshop of the world, we are doomed effectively, because we will never be the cheapest people, or we shouldn't want to be the people who work for the lowest wages. And so it requires a complete volt face as far as our industry in recent decades is concerned. And I mentioned last week about the way in which lots of third world countries are deterred from growing the food that their people need to eat, and instead are encouraged to grow tobacco crops and to grow palm oil crops and things of this sort, stuff that their people can't live on. And then what it means is that those third world countries are then vulnerable to changes in economic circumstances, where the prices of commodities change. And as the prices of commodities such as palm oil and tobacco change, then it can mean that their country experiences great hardship. And in that it experiences great hardship, if there's a drop in the price of tobacco, for example, that the people of that country can't eat tobacco leaves. And what they've got is a crop that they're then struggling to sell, and that they're then having to sell for a lower price, which means they've got less money to buy the food that they then need to feed themselves. So this isn't just a problem for Britain. This is a problem for all of the nations of the world, that the international commercial idea, the globalist commercial idea, has a massive flaw in it, and that flaw is that it encourages nations to organize themselves in such a way that they become overly dependent upon one industry, and often overly dependent upon an industry the product of which is something that can't provide for their long-term security and can't provide for their nourishment during the bad years that come between the good years, effectively.
We've also got built-in obsolescence into the products that we do make, so that they break down and you have to purchase a new one, whereas before you used to be able to repair things, and things were created with the idea that they would last forever, and you would just repair them. And now also the workshop of the world is no longer Britain, it's China. I was, you know, quite surprised to see that the whole idea at the time was to say that Britain was going to be the workshop of the world, because I thought I thought they had them producing stuff out there in India, and this was the idea of the British Empire. But no, it was Britain that was doing all the work. It was Britain that was the workshop, and we're told, you know, we have this white privilege. It was all just suddenly given to us. No, it wasn't. Our ancestors worked to the bone to provide what we have for us today. So it's interesting to see here the way that this all came about. Quoting again here, "My ideal is that each individual should seek his advantage in cooperation with his fellows, and that the people should make the best of their own country before attempting to trade with other peoples. I propose, Mr. Smith, and I submit the proposal to you, who are a sensible and practical man, as a sensible and practical proposal, that we should first of all ascertain what things are desirable for our health and happiness of body and mind, and that we should then organise our people with the object of producing those things in the best and the easiest way. So what do you think he's really talking about here then, for the happiness of body and mind and desirable for our health? I guess for the health he's talking about agriculture. Well, what about the happiness of body and mind? What sort of things is he talking about there that he wants us to be producing, Max, do you think?
Well, he's prioritising the uplifting of the amenity in which we live, of making our housing better, making the environment better, making our population stronger and healthier and more vigorous than it otherwise would be, and placing those things above the drive for profit. You know, money has to change hands in a society in order to facilitate the purchase of things and the sale of things, and that's obvious. But the accumulation of ever increasingly large amounts of money serves no purpose other than to flatter the ego of the person who owns the means of production. And what we've got to try and do is to make people who are blessed with ownership of the means of production to see that their task, first and foremost, shouldn't be just to line their own pockets at the expense of the rest of the nation in order to by treating both the British people and foreigners alike as punters, that they want to sell their goods that are produced as cheaply as possible for the highest possible price, but that they should want the assets that they hold and the assets of our society as a whole to be used for the betterment of our people. And it's people that do that who really deserve to have their lives memorialized in statues and other monuments around the country. So it was in times gone by that people who created great wealth and who donated their great wealth to charitable causes, that they were celebrated and their lives were memorialized and monuments were built to them. And it's just a shame now that the work that they have done in the past is now being denigrated, and that the statues and the monuments are being despoiled.
You know, I think what's at the root of this problem really is usury, because money should really just be a measure of value to facilitate exchange, the exchange of goods. And once you start adding interest to it, then money becomes a cause of its own, and people want to have as much money as they can, because then they can make as much money as they can out of it with usury, instead of it just being used as a measure of value, so that you can exchange one lot of goods for another.
But also in our society now, somebody who accumulates a massive fortune during their life is regarded as being a great and wonderful person because they've got all that money, irrespective of how they've actually accumulated that money, and what ought to be the measure of somebody is that, yes, if they can accumulate great wealth, then that's great, but what do they spend their great wealth on? And have they accumulated their great wealth simply by cheating other people? Because there is, you know, within economics, there is the drive for companies to find ever cheaper and cheaper and cheaper ways of producing whatever it is they sell, and of them then using advertising in order to be able to command the highest possible price for what they're selling. And I think it was Gerald Ratner who some decades ago fell from grace when he made a public admission, when he was giving an after dinner speech, that the object of his company was to, I'm paraphrasing what he said, but it was to produce crap and to sell it at the highest possible price. And he said that as a semi-serious joke at some after dinner speech, but it actually was the undoing of his company, and he lost a tremendous amount of a tremendous amount of credit for doing that. But the point is, you know, in some respects, it was an admission of what lots of people in commerce have been doing over recent decades.
Yeah, and an admission of truth. And I mean, what happened to these great philanthropists? I mean, we've talked about some of them, you know, Edward Colston, Cecil Rhodes. I mean, these people that made lots of wealth in the past, they used that wealth to set up endowments, to set up hospitals, to set up schools, to provide ways for their people to better themselves. And that's why we have statues of them. And now they're saying, well, we must pull them down because they had something to do with the British Empire. And if it wasn't for the British Empire, half the people that are now telling us the British Empire is wrong would not have even been educated in the first place. They wouldn't have been given a scholarship. They wouldn't have been taught. They wouldn't have been educated. It's scandalous. But to get back to the quotes here, now to our problem. How are we to make the best of our country and of our lives? What things do we need in order to secure a happy, healthy, and worthy human life? A life which consists of nothing but eating and drinking and sleeping and working is not a human life. It is the life of a beast. Such a life is not worth living. If we are to spend all our days and nights in a kind of penal servitude, continually toiling and suffering in order to live, we had better break at once the chains of our bitter slavery and die. And I think this is interesting, where he said the things that people need as a human being, we need to be happy, we need to be healthy, and we need to have led a worthy human life. I mean, how many people today would count living a worthy human life as being of the utmost importance in how people are supposed to live? This gives us an idea of how moral the people were back then. It was considered important that what they did was actually worthy, not just all about hedonism, not just all about accumulating whatever you can for yourself, but did you do things for others during your life? Were you a worthy human being? I mean, that's what really strikes me about this quote here, Max.
Yeah, absolutely right. And again, it sort of comes back to how you measure the worth of somebody's life. Do you measure it by the size of their bank balance, irrespective of how that enormous bank balance may have been accumulated? Or do you measure it by the amount of good that person's done in helping other people to be better than they otherwise might have been?
You know, I consider what we do here at Radio Albion to be very worthy. You know, we work here to try and provide content for our people, and we all see it as a duty that we do this. If we can do it, then we should. I'm proud of Radio Albion. I think it is a worthy enterprise. Getting back to these quotes here, to ensure good health, we must lead a natural life. The further we get from nature, the more artificial our lives become, the worse is our health. The chief ends to health are pure air, pure water, pure and sufficient food, cleanliness, exercise, rest, warmth, and ease of mind. The chief obstacles to health are impure air, impure water, bad or insufficient food, gluttony, drunkenness, vice, dirt, heavy labour, want of rest, exposure, and anxiety of mind. And once again, we see that the moral side here, the obstacles to health are gluttony, drunkenness, vice. And today, I mean, you got pornography everywhere. You've got women selling themselves as pop stars and selling their bodies on the television, or showing off their bodies in order to make money. And that is not seen as an obstacle to health. We're being told that fat is beautiful. We're being told that we shouldn't even say the word fat. I forget what the word is now. Body something or other for overweight people. Never mind the fact
body
that
body positivity.
Body positivity. That's it. No, never mind the fact that obesity leads to it leads to all sorts of diseases. Drunkenness. Think of the amount of drunkenness that we see on the streets, particularly with women now over the weekends. And then also here, where he says, the further we get from nature, the more artificial our lives become. And again, as nationalists, we're all about adhering to natural law, and we lead synthetic lives now, where we are completely separated from nature. And the air back then, I guess one good thing is that the air back now is much better than it was back then. When you think about the pea soup fogs that they had back then. Anything else to add to that?
Also, one of the things that's quite interesting in that statement that you read was the fact that back in the early part of the last century, Robert Blatchford had focused on anxiety of mind as being a key thing in producing ill health in the population. And it's only now, only in recent years, that the epidemic of mental illness has come to the fore, and that people have started to focus on the fact that there is so much mental illness. And the fact of the matter is that mental illness is exacerbated by the stresses that are created by living in multicultural societies, and societies where success is valued solely on how you look and how much money you have, and all the trappings of wealth. And yet Robert Blatchford, a national socialist, was already 100 years ago on the right track as far as that sort of thing is concerned, and several decades full of Labour and Conservative politicians have overlooked something he brought to the public for over 100 years ago.
I think also where he's talking here about the how we don't have the pure air, I think that was personal for him as well, because he had two children that died, didn't he, when they died young.
That's right.
I think it was to do with something to do with the lungs, I seem to remember. Well, continuing, the sure marks of good health are physical strength and beauty. Look at the statue of an ancient Greek athlete, and then at the form of a modern sweater's slave, and you will see how true this is. Now, this I think is very important, because we look at these Greek statues and we think they are the epitome of manhood, and obviously they look like they're working out in the gymnasium and they're incredibly fit. Well, no, that's what people used to look like. We've lost 20% of our testosterone in the last 20 years since they have been measuring it. It's dropped on average. Back then we had much more testosterone. We had people that were ill when they were young, they would die off. They wouldn't get to an adult age, and they wouldn't breed. And everybody was extremely fit and healthy. And if you're fit and healthy of body, you're going to be fit and healthy of mind. I mean, Dr. Edward Dutton has done loads of research into this, and the fact that there are more and more mutant genes which cause people to have uneven faces, unsymmetrical faces, ugly faces. And that is basically showing on the outside what is there on the inside. And that's why they have these maladaptive ideas. That's why we have these leftist ideas. That's why we have these suicidal ideas like multiculturalism and the promotion of homosexualism. It's because they have these mutant genes. And the mutant genes show on the face where they're asymmetrical. And they also show on the inside on the brain. And he's pointing this out there in the language of the day, saying, look at the statue of an ancient Greek athlete. That is what you should look like. That is the example of physical strength, beauty, and health. And also that would have been a sign of mental strength. If you look at our politicians today, they are all so ugly. And I can't for the life of me think that our leaders looked anything like that in the past. I think they would have been the absolute epitome of beauty and health. They would have been high IQ, and they would have been absolutely beautiful looking, noble looking as well. Nothing like the ugliness that we see today in our politicians. They have ugly minds and ugly bodies. There is a link between the two. You know, to a certain extent, you can tell what somebody is like from looking at their facial features. There used to be an entire science in this, but now it's been made politically incorrect. But again, I think he's really sort of presaging things that we're finding out scientifically today, back then, by pointing out these links between health, physical strength, beauty, and look at the Greek athlete, particularly to do with these hormone imbalances that we have today. I don't know if you want to add to that, Max.
I'm just trying to think whether it was Plato or Socrates that said monstrum in front, monstrum in animo, which basically meant that if you are a monster in appearance, you'll be a monster in spirit.
Yeah, well, just look at Gordon Brown. You know, I mean, even Boris Johnson, look at his hair. I mean, it's a right state. I guess Boris Johnson's probably better than better than most, but you compare that to Gordon Brown, it's just awful. He says, now I shall show you later that hardly any of our people lead natural and healthy lives. I shall show you that the average Briton might be very much healthier, handsomer, and stronger than he is. And I shall show you that the average duration of life might easily be doubled. I shall show you later that our people are badly clothed and badly fed and badly housed, that some have more, but most have less than is good for them, and that with a quarter of the labour now expended in getting improper sustenance, we might produce proper sustenance and plenty of it for all. And again, this is interesting because we know now that people back then, they didn't actually live to the fullness of their phenotype because of the bad diets that they actually had. And this is why when you look at in the past, some of the older houses have got lower doors and they've got lower ceilings. And it's because the people back then didn't have good enough food to eat. So they didn't actually reach the fullness of their phenotype. And we also know that people used to live a lot longer years ago. People used to live a lot longer because they had a much healthier diet. So he's also putting this link there between the diet that we have and the actual length of life that people have. He's saying that it could easily be doubled. I mean, that's quite incredible, that.
Well, I think it has almost, we're well on the way to doubling it, in fact, in view of the fact that I think the average life expectancy at birth for a man in 1900 was 52, whereas it's now something like 82. And so we've added 30 years onto that. But the point is that because of the fact that the rise in education, the rise in medical treatment, etc., that has caused the average life expectancy to increase in this country over the course of the last 100 years, because that rise has started to slow down and to stall, we're now seeing a situation where average life expectancy is starting to go down again. And that is as a result of the sort of modern trends in society. And so we do need to reverse the things that are making our country sick. And the primary thing that's making our country sick is the dispossession of our people and the mass immigration to this country, which is the source of so much of the hardship and so much of the problems that beset us in our society today.
The unnatural surroundings that we live in. I mean, living amongst people that aren't of your own kind, your body doesn't even produce the right hormones that it should be producing. Oxytocin is the hormone that we should be producing when we're around our own kind. It's the same hormone that is produced between a mother and the baby when the baby is suckling, to produce a sense of bonding between the two and a sense of happiness. And we produce this hormone when we're around our own people, and it's conducive to being social. And when we're around other races, we don't produce this hormone. We don't produce it, so our bodies are not saying we should be sociable, we should be nice to these people. Our body are saying the opposite of that. So we're constantly on edge just because of the people we are around. And I also think an old saying used to be, you are what you eat. So this is linked into it as well. Not just the surroundings and the people that we are around, but also the food that we eat is so important. And he was realizing all of this and tying it into the nationalist ideology and the socialist ideology. Well, I think we should probably leave that there for this week, Max. Unless you've got anything else you'd like to say?
No, I think we've covered a fair bit of the ground that he covers in the book already, and we can look forward to covering some more in the weeks to come.
Okay, well, thank you very much for coming on today.
No, it's my pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Monday with more Real Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.